This is The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week, residents from West Oahu got a chance to learn about how the state is exploring a different way to get motorists to pay for using our highways and freeways. It's a road usage plan that's being shopped around the state, and DOT officials hope to get buy-in. Jack Legal is the chairman of the Kapolei Neighborhood Board. He was at a meeting on Oahu's west side Wednesday night and says there was quite a bit of pushback.
So the reaction was, it was very contentious. There was a lot of pushback from the audience. Still a lot of uncertainty as to what the state is trying to do. Of course, they're saying that it's a replacement for the fuel tax, right, for the state part. But there's still not. There's still a lot of doubt as to where the money is going to go, and why are they not fixing the road right now? Of course, the state is looking forward toward 2045, and everybody has to have electric cars, right? And when I talk to some of the audience, we have audience all the way from Kahalu and Waianae area. And I was talking to the guy from Kahalu, and he said, you know what, they are forcing us to buy electric cars, and I will never buy electric cars because it will be expensive to replace the batteries. And what they should do is reduce my registration fee, things like that.
Now, the state is holding additional meetings on Kauai and Maui this week and into next week. Highways Administrator Ed Sniffen sat down with us in studio to explain what's in store.
Road usage charge is something we're moving towards to see how we can keep our funding that's necessary to upkeep the road sustainable. Definitely, as we go through, we see more cars with higher mileage per gallon, which is awesome. Fuel efficiency is excellent. We also see that Hawaii is the number two market where electric vehicles are penetrating into, which is amazing because it fits with our sustainability goals. That all being said, we still have to look at how we can maintain our roads. Funding that's coming in right now is not going down yet. It's flat. But the cost to do business always go up. So in general, we're at a negative on the funding side. The road usage charge is just one of the alternates that we're looking for to see how we can best fit the road usage charge to ensure that everybody pays their fair share. That's all it is.
Okay. I know you're going to get pushback from folks who do drive in from, let's say, the other side of the island or from the west side. And then if it's the big island, you know, oh my gosh, they've got so much territory to cover.
Definitely. So at this time, really what the gas tax is right now is a road usage charge. It used to capture when everybody had the same platforms on the type of mileage they get, the type of driving they do. It used to capture very equally for everybody the charge that you pay to maintain your roads. Now, though, with the disparity in the mileage that somebody gets, even in gas-burning cars, and with electric vehicles where they don't even pay gas at all, there is a disparity now in the way people are charged for their road usage. So we're just trying to get back to that parity. Now, this may not be the best way, but the best way to consider it is to study it. We have a round of public meetings coming up to make sure that we get feedback from the public. What we're doing is a 3-year study that we're being funded by the federal government for to make sure that we come up with a report with recommendations at the end. The town hall meetings that we're having will inform how this study moves forward. So we've set a general guideline of what we'd like to do, but based on the feedback we get from the community, we may adjust it as we go forward. Definitely on the west side, and especially where people drive more, they feel they're going to get charged more than everybody else. That's not necessarily the case, because if everybody's driving platform were the same, they'd be charged for the mileage that they drive, just like everybody else would.
Is this the same as congestion pricing?
Not necessarily, because congestion pricing, that would say that we would increase the cost for you to drive in different areas at different times. So say we did a congestion pricing on H1. During the AM peaks and the PM peaks, we would tell everybody, in order to drive on this roadway, you'd pay a higher rate than you would drive normally. That's not what we're trying to do. We're just trying to capture everybody's real usage of the roadway to get the charges from them that they should pay based on what they used.
I guess at first blush, though, you think, okay, mm-hmm. I'm paying more for gas and I'm driving further, so this is eating my money out of my pocketbook.
So the thought process right now is right. The gas tax is the gas tax. The more you drive, the more you pay. That's what the road usage charge would kind of mirror. The more you drive, the more you'd pay. Now, different ways of collecting that information are being considered. One foolproof way is to low-jack your car. So I know everywhere you went, every mile you drove. Some people may have problems with that.
Okay.
I for one. But there's other ways we could do it. There's potentials that you could take a picture of your odometer with your phone through an app. For Hawaii, one of the best things we have is we still have our safety inspection. So at the end of the year, when you do your safety inspection, we could capture that information there. So there's different ways we can consider getting that information in. The difficult thing now is how do you pay for it? So if we had a vehicle tracking mechanism in your car, we could break it down into biweekly or monthly payments because we would know where you would, how many miles you'd drive. Now, if we went to on the other end with just safety inspection information, I won't know until the end of the year, which means I can only bill you once. So that fuel usage charge or that fuel tax that you're paying right now or the road usage charge you're paying now through fuel tax, you're breaking it up into small increments throughout. Very easy to do. If you had to pay it all at one time, though, some people may have concerns about that. And those are the things we want to know as we go forward on the study.
Right, because I think maybe that's the greatest fear is because you're thinking, do I have to cut a check for whatever, $500 or $1,000 at one fell swoop?
That's exactly it. So that's the concerns that we want to hear from the community to see how best to address them. I know I would have that kind of concern.
Where do you drive in from?
I'm in Aiea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not too far.
So not too far. Not west side, but definitely not close, not in town. So I would have the concern that if I had to pay it all at once, I'd have to plan for it as we go through. There's several things we could look at. I mean, if we did consider collecting all information at the safety inspection, but putting out anticipated billings monthly to ensure that we re-up at the end, maybe that's something we could do. I know that some utilities do it in some seasons that are very difficult to collect the information. But again, this is what we want to hear from the community.
What about the problem that we might have if someone messes with the odometer?
And those are the things. So as difficult as a lift as it would be for the public to change the way they pay for their road usage, it's that big for the state as well. Right now, for me, when I collect the fuel charge that comes in, it's very easy. Dole tax, they collect all the taxes coming in, they cut the check over to highways, and we move forward with the funding we have. We move to a system like this, we got to set up our internal controls to make sure we are ready for the billings to come through. We also got to set up our internal controls on how we enforce. And those are things that are, very distant from my thought process as we go through now. So it's a huge lift for the state to convert to a system like this as well.
Right, the administrative costs.
Absolutely.
Now, can we look to anywhere in the country or in the world where this is in place and they have an efficient system to capture the information?
I don't know about efficient yet, but Oregon, Washington, California, Oregon, Washington, California, they're all ahead of us in their studies. Oregon actually started their program already. They finished up their pilots, they finished up their studies, and they've put into place a road usage charge system. And those are for people who opt in at this time. California, they just finished up their pilots. They haven't instated it yet. Washington's kind of in that same vein. And Colorado is moving along at the same pace as we are. So Oregon is definitely one we can look towards. They've vetted the issues with how to collect information, how to set up their internals, and how to make sure that everybody's ready for it. They haven't pulled the trigger on saying that this is the way we will collect tax in the future, though.
At this point, then, we've got a couple of other locations to look at, but they're even still early on in the process. But it'll be at least 3 years before you folks do anything.
Absolutely. So the process we're going through here is a three-year study. We have not presupposed that this is the way that we're going to transition to. Not at all. We're moving forward on this study mainly because we know something has to be done to ensure that we can keep the funding levels consistent as we go through, but also fully understanding that the federal government has a vested interest in this. So they funded us $4 million for this study to ensure we move it forward. Now, the only deliverable that they want out of this is a report with recommendations. They have not said you move forward on this, you must put it in place. So everybody should understand, this is still a work in progress as we go. When we talk to those in California and Oregon, they caution us in telling us, don't think this is a short-term thing. For Oregon and California, they look at about 10 years to go from fuel tax to a road usage charge if that's what we decide to do.
What are the other alternatives?
It could be just a further increase in the fuel tax. I mean, it's simplistic. There's less people using fuel, so those that use fuel will charge them more. To me, that's not parity. That's not equality. There's some people who will be paying less for their road usage than others. So it's kind of a regressive tax. Other potentials could be looking at increases in the other fees, maybe registration, maybe weight tax, to ensure that everybody who has a vehicle, is charged about the same to ensure that they're paying their fair share.
And you have come in to advocate for those hikes, for those user charges over the last couple of years, but haven't been successful.
That's exactly right. So the legislators, of course, are hearing from their communities saying that the cost of living is just too high in Hawaii. So they're supporting their constituents and saying that let's hold off a bit on this. And totally understand. Totally understandable. I know there's people who, when they see their bill for their registration fees, for their weight tax, it's big already. And everybody got to understand that those fees are not the state's. They're being broken up between the state and the counties in their different areas. But I get it. So for us, we always go in to let everybody know that if the community wants us to move forward on safety and preservation, to make sure that the roads we have are safe and will be around for a long time, and they want capacity, more roads to make sure that their time in congestion is less, this is the type of funding we need. If I cannot get it, I never say I'm not going to do my job. I just let everybody know how I can do it with a different boundary around what's prioritized.
So if not this, then hiking the gas tax potentially, or something else.
Or something else. Or not increasing anything, but decreasing the types of services that we can do.
I guess the concern is because we have rail and we don't know yet about the costs for operating. And so that's, I think, probably something on people's minds.
Absolutely. So when we start looking at these mega projects like a rail, when it comes through, it'll be billions of dollars that were put into it. And of course, everybody wants to see how we're going to maintain that. Of course, they want to see where the funding is going to come from to do that. And absolutely the right thing to consider. For us, though, we still have a mission that we got to follow. Now, given rail and given the other disruptors in the industry, so rail, we have Uber and Lyft operating. We have the bus system that's going to change into a hub and spoke with rail. I don't definitively know what the demands on the state system will be. With rail coming in, with Uber and Lyft, maybe people decide I don't need a car anymore. And maybe the number of cars on the road come down. And maybe the wear and tear on the road or the new roads that we got to build all come down, which would be awesome. But I'm not sure yet. Or maybe because Uber and Lyft is operating and more people are ordering that service, maybe they're driving more. Maybe those Uber and Lyft drivers will be circulating on our system more, and maybe the congestion goes up. I'm not sure. But we want to make sure that we're prioritizing what the needs are and planning for that future.
And right now we need input from the public. It doesn't matter where you live. The state wants to hear from you. We've got these meetings throughout the state over the next several weeks. So the most important thing is input.
Definitely. And we'd love people to come out to the meetings to make sure they give us their input out there. We'll have our consultants, our staff all out there to make sure that we take in everybody's input.
That was State Highways Administrator Ed Sniffen talking about the road usage plan and the meetings that it's launched to get feedback. There are a couple meetings on Kauai tonight and Saturday, and then on Maui, March 25th through the 27th, and then the Big Island on April 9th. We will post the full statewide schedule on hawaiipublicradio.org. We also plan a call-in show for sometime in April. And on Monday, you will hear more from Ed Sniffen. As we've just learned, the state has now switched to a new formula for paving our highways and freeways. It's a new asphalt mix, more expensive, but officials believe it'll last longer. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Dick Dale, the guitarist known for creating the surf sound of the 60s. He died on Saturday at the age of 81. And we listen back to our interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet W.S. Merwin, who also died last week. He was 91. Join us.
This afternoon at 3. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor locations.
Lots of coming and going. The Department of Public Safety sent over a number of inmates from Maui who they believe had a part in the uprising at the Maui Community Correctional Center, and they sent some back. They're still trying to sort through who is responsible for what. Director Nolan Espinda just returned from Maui to see the damage caused. We spoke with him about what led to the riot and what steps are being taken to ensure it doesn't happen again.
Well, you know, all the Maui staff are working extended hours to make sure that recovery and restoration process is expedited. The units themselves, they have been cleaned up, but they remain unusable in some of the areas due to the need to replace security glass windows, damaged security doors, and tables and chairs. During the course of the incident, individual toilets and sinks were damaged and destroyed in many cases, and alternate unrestricted toilet access and restricted shower access is being provided for every inmate. We've been working with our vendors coming in and out on a regular basis to provide us with estimates and services to make sure that we restore the fixtures and sinks. Restoration companies come in to assist us and provide us a estimate on the cost for some of the fire damage that occurred along the walls. We're letting the inmates out of their cells to participate in recreation 3 or 4 cells at a time and continue to have a physical presence on our perimeters just as a precaution to make sure that this disturbance does not multiply in any way. We have medical staff flown in from Honolulu as well as the medical staff there who are regularly making their rounds in the modules to make sure all inmates are seen and that all consults are conducted. And you know, we're continuing to look into the investigation with the assistance of my deputy director for corrections, my institution division administrator, as well as our security coordinator, all who have been dispatched to the institution to assist with the aftermath of the situation.
And you were there yourself this week to see firsthand the damage done.
That's correct, yes.
Some might ask, why didn't you go sooner?
You know, it was a really calculated matter. They needed assistance immediately from people who could provide it directly. The tendency when a director comes on site is for everything to stop and it's disruptive. And in fact, on Tuesday, some of that occurred. Inmates became agitated because of my presence. So we were more concerned about providing the direct assistance they needed to get basic services and supplies necessary to the institution. And it was only when the situation calmed down and we had removed most of the primary protagonists involved that I went over, most especially to provide support to the staff and express my appreciation for the hard work they've been doing during the course of this incident.
And is there anything you want to say to the first responders? Because police and fire also responded that first day.
Absolutely. I took the time to reach out to the chief of police, the chief of the fire department, and the mayor himself as soon as the following day of the incident, because they, in a multi-agency response, without hesitation, came to the assistance of the people at the prison. And without their assistance and their help, we would not have been able to get the situation under control as quickly as they did. What these people did is in the the very finest example of public service.
And as far as the recovery for the facility, do we need to tap into emergency monies?
We will be asking for emergency monies during the course of this legislative session. We will be redirecting some funds from our current budget to assist with the recovery, but it will be a long and exhaustive process.
We have over the years heard the Maui lawmakers beat the drum about the condition of the facility. Where are we at in the matrix as far as, fixing the problem and expanding capacity over there? I know there have been a number of issues raised by, I believe, even the ACOs, the staff, about the deteriorating conditions at that prison, just the physical layout and the physical part of the facility.
We were granted money in 2017 for a expansion unit there. The planning process is well underway, and we should soon be requesting the release of the construction funds. That will help not to add to the inmate population, but essentially to be able to more properly house people who are currently sleeping on the floor. The population there is a jail population, and those people are sent to us by the courts, and unfortunately, we have no ability to in any way release these people due to the overcrowded condition. So we really are had been hoping for, you know, some form of bail reform, relief of that nature, because us in corrections and law and the jail business faced a very daunting and difficult task of not being able to turn anybody away from the front door and having to squeeze in every person that is sent to us by the courts.
Right. You're trying to do the best you can with the facilities that you've got to deal with.
That's correct.
And, so is there anything you want to say to the community just about this incident? I mean, it's unfortunate, you know, the planning's underway, you're about to expand, but, you know, what led to this riot or to this disturbance there?
Extreme overcrowded conditions and the situations that occur relative to that. We had 96 people and 95 people in areas designed to house 48 people. So where there's supposed to be two in a cell, there were four in a cell. And these types of difficult conditions, you know, really exacerbate every little problem. Every time a toilet is down, every time a telephone is down, it's multiplied by four. What I would want to say to the Maori community there is that these difficult conditions have persisted for years. We are working towards establishing additional housing for the people there. We would eventually like to be a participant in the expansion that will happen out there for a new correctional facility itself. I guess in closing, I'd say that the public servants that work at the institution, the first responders that came out, the people who showed up in support of the staff there during the course of this incident, is truly a credit to the Maori community.
Do you think we could have avoided this?
I don't, you know, what happened is due to overcrowding. We cannot control the overcrowding. I don't, want to make up, any kind of statement that it could have been prevented. The people there did their job as they were trained to do, responded appropriately to a very difficult situation. And all we can do is work every single day to assure that the community and the public is safe. Because regardless of what happened in the institution, our staff and the first responders there assured that the public safety was maintained and that all people were retained within the walls of the institution.
There is concern also for the staff. Will any folks from Honolulu be there to, for the long run, to just make sure that things are under control there?
Our staffing at the institution is being assisted by our Sheriff's Division where possible. We've not had any restriction on overtime. We're allowing the staff to add additional personnel on an overtime basis as is needed. We will provide all institutional assistance from our other facilities regarding operations, maintenance, and supplies. But this is something we have to work through, and it's taken one step at a time, and we need to make individual improvements on the conditions there every day so that the staff and inmates realize that we are on the road back to normalcy.
You did also have a number of the detainees there sent over to Honolulu. How long do you think that situation is going to last? Any feel for that?
Not at this time. We're still in the midst of an investigation, of course, and that will determine what internal sanctions these individuals may or may not receive. As our investigation proceeded, of course, you saw that we brought five people back to Maui, and we expect that decisions made regarding information revealed under the investigation will continue to make this a moving target.
We did have a situation here with a federal consent decree. You worried that something might happen there on Maui?
Oh, we're always concerned that overcrowded conditions can create this type of scenario, and indeed this time it did. Overcrowding and the conditions related to it are generally what causes the federal government to open their eyes and look over our shoulder. I have been ringing that bell every year at the legislature that we risk federal intervention if we do not either amend our sentencing laws and or adjust the way we make decisions on the detention of pretrial detainees. Until actual actions take on these particular issues, we will continue to be plagued with the problem of overcrowding in our jails.
And is there anything else you can share with us? There was the situation over at OCCC where someone tried to escape. Maurice Abiscato Jr. was shot. That investigation is still underway. Anything you can share with us at this point?
Unfortunately, no. It is a very serious situation. We will continue to investigate it administratively, and we await HPD's decision on any type of criminal proceedings that may ensue. But at this point in time, all I can say is that we are diligently investigating that situation.
Can you say whether the staff followed proper procedures in transporting the detainee back to OCCC, or should they have called an ambulance?
Again, all I can say is this is all under investigation, and those things will be determined through the course of that investigation. I will not jump in and second-guess anyone's motives, actions at this point in time. Everyone deserves to have this matter professionally investigated and decisions rendered thereafter.
That was Director of Public Safety Nolan Espinda talking about the recent uprising at the Maui jailhouse. Espinda is still awaiting a confirmation hearing as a holdover for Governor David Ige's cabinet, but so far the Senate has not scheduled one. Our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat have a story they enterprised about vaccinations. Alan Perichini found out that Kauai has the largest number of unvaccinated school children in the state. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
You know, I have to say, I was really surprised by this. I thought it might be someplace like the Big Island.
Well, there were many people who speculated that that might be the case, particularly relating to the Big Island and also Maui. But I had an inkling all along in this project that Kauai would turn out to be the hotbed, and when we got the data yesterday from the health department, indeed that is the case. We have a school on island, the Alakaio Kauai Charter School, where 40% of the kids are not vaccinated based on a religious exemption. And if you go down the list, Hanalei Elementary, which is a public school, 29%. Kanui Kapono Charter School, 32.9%. Kauai Christian Academy, 21.9%. Kilauea Elementary, which is a public school, 33%. Those are very high numbers.
Very high. Very surprising to me. Really eye-opening.
Well, it was not necessarily a surprise, but the people I've talked to in the school industry and in the health department were surprised, not that it was Kauai, but that the numbers were, in fact, that astronomical. I mean, it's mind-boggling, although there is a school elsewhere in the state with a much higher rate even than that. It's the Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, which has 245 students, and 52.7% of them are unvaccinated based on a religious objection.
Yeah, that really is. That is amazing. And this is, we should point out, right, it's both public and private schools.
This is public, private, and charter. And the private schools include religious schools of all types.
And so what does the Department of Health say?
Well, the Department of Health is concerned. They had had some issues with getting up-to-date data in their records, and they'd had some staffing problems. When we originally started asking them to release these data, their response initially was that their staffing shortage was severe enough that they hadn't been able to gather it for the current school year. They did, to their credit, about 3 weeks ago, gave all the schools in the state 2 weeks to comply, and while not all of them did, the vast majority are represented in the numbers we got, and I think the health department is as concerned as we are, although they would have to speak for themselves.
It would be interesting to see if that number changes for the next year.
It will be very interesting to see what happens. When you look back, we have 6 years of data, and I've actually just been sitting here looking at as far back as the 2014-2015 school year. And generally speaking, there isn't much change year to year. In Hanalei's case, they're essentially flat from 2014-15 to the present, although Kilauea represents a kind of worrisome trend. They're up about 5 percentage points in terms of religious exemptions in that particular school, which is caught my attention because I live in Kilauea, and the school is about a block down the street.
Well, it'd be interesting to see, you know, with this information out, if parents will, if that'll affect their decision one way or the other, where they send their kids to school.
I think that's a key question. If you, what these data should let parents do is ask a question, is it safe to send my child to that school? And I think in some of these cases, when you have a situation where 40% of children are unvaccinated or 33% of children unvaccinated, that's a real question for parents. Even if you have a successful measles vaccination, for example, in two rounds, you're still only 98% protected. So a vaccinated child could conceivably get measles from an unvaccinated child, even though his or her risk would be much smaller than it would be without vaccination. But it's certainly possible that even vaccinated children can be infected by unvaccinated children.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because just yesterday, my daughter, who's in her 20s, asked me, Mom, do I have all my vaccines? You know, and I said, yes, you do. And she said, thank you. So all very interesting. But thanks so much, Alan.
Okay. Have a nice day.
All righty. That was columnist Alan Parrucchini with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Diamond Head Theater. Something Rotten spoofs Shakespeare as Nick and Nigel Bottom aim to outdo the playwright's success by writing a musical in the 1590s, now through April 14th. DiamondHeadTheater.com.
It's been 2 weeks since the for-profit college, Argosy University, closed its doors nationwide. Here in Hawaii, two local universities have been competing to take over an Argosy Hawaii program that has major public policy implications for Hawaii. HPR's Ryan Finnerty has been following the story and joins us in studio for an update. Morning.
Morning, Catherine.
So what's the latest?
Well, so Catherine, to do a quick recap, you folks might remember that it was 2 weeks ago today, Argosy University nationwide closed its 22 campuses. Here in Hawaii, there were three campuses, and several hundred students and around 50 employees were affected by that closure. And what quickly emerged the following week was a sort of competition over what you might call the crown jewel of the Argosy Hawaii program, which was a doctoral program in clinical psychology. And that's significant because it was one of only two schools in Hawaii that had an accredited doctoral program for psychology, the other one being at UH Manoa. And so the two schools were Hawaii Pacific University and Chaminade University, both in Honolulu. They both have master's level psychology programs, but this is really the highest level, akin to almost medical school for mental health providers. And so they both had stepped in to say, we want to take over this program, teach these students, bring in new students. And that's sort of where the confusion began, because these types of programs need to be accredited by the American Psychological Association and another agency that does normal college accreditation. And you can run a program like this without accreditation, but it's problematic for the students because many employers require psychologists to have graduate from an APA-accredited program. So it can cause problems down the line for students. And Argosy Hawaii's program was accredited. But what emerged was that accreditation cannot be transferred to another school. It's tied to that university. So when Argosy ceased to exist, that APA accreditation went with it. And here's the American Psychological Association's chief education officer, Catherine Gruss.
At this point in time, we've been providing consultation actually to a number of programs that are interested in receiving Argosy students. We have not received any specific plans yet from any program for us to review and again review for consistency with our standards for accreditation. Prospective students need to keep in mind that if they're entering in a program that's not currently accredited but is trying to make this temporary arrangement, hopefully they're able to do everything such that they could be granted this temporary status. But there is certainly that has to be reviewed, and it could be a scenario where perhaps the program is not able to, on first pass, get this temporary accreditation status.
That's interesting.
So it's a big deal, and the APA stressed that it wants to help universities achieve this. It wants to help. There are 8 of these doctoral psychology programs at Argosy campuses around the country. So this is happening in other states and other communities. And the APA wants to help other existing universities take in these students, complete their training, and get them out into the workforce.
Do we know how many students we're talking about at Argosy?
It's about 80, anywhere from 80 to 100. It's not exactly clear because some have already decided they're going to transfer to the mainland, go to another school. Some students told me they were considering just dropping out altogether and staying at the master's level. There were a lot of financial concerns with student loans and that sort of thing. But a lot of them do want to stay. They want to stay with their professors. They want to stay in Hawaii, and Hawaii needs new psychologists. So that's where a lot of this confusion was generated, because apparently in the beginning, Hawaii Pacific University was where this program was going to go, and that's what students were being told. And then that changed last week. Students told me that they were kind of abruptly notified by some of their faculty that they were now going to Chaminade. And then on Monday of this week, March 18th, Chaminade University put out a statement saying that it was welcoming the Argosy psychology program, including all students and faculty. And that kind of caused some confusion amongst the students, amongst the community, because it came out of the blue sky, sort of. And in that press release, Chaminade President Lynn Babington is quoted as saying, quote, "We appreciate the swift action pending approvals from the 2 accrediting agencies," end quote. And so that caused even more confusion, because as we just heard, the APA hasn't received any applications for accreditation, or at least as of 2 days ago when I spoke with them. And we now know that accreditation can't be transferred. So I called President Babington to discuss the situation and get some clarity as to what they meant by that. And here's what she told me.
"We received from the Argosy bankruptcy receiver an exclusive agreement to transfer the Argosy Hawaii program to Chaminade University of Honolulu. We hired the director, Sean Scanlon, who previously was the director at Argosy Hawaii. Yesterday, he became part of our faculty, and the rest of the faculty are coming over for lunch, and we are talking to them about the opportunity to join Chaminade's faculty and continue teaching in this program. We expect that they all will, because verbally they've given that agreement. We've put together sort of a transition curriculum so that the students who were dropped partway through their semester can complete the courses they were taking."
So again, we're not really sure what that agreement entails. And so that agreement was with a court-appointed receiver who's been managing Argosy's affairs. It's not clear what that actually means legally, or whether it's even permissible is the word a lot of people have used. The Department of Education said they were aware of it, the U.S. Department of Education, but they didn't know enough to provide any kind of clarity on the situation yet. And it's not clear what that means for students. As we heard, the head of the Argosy program has signed on with Chaminade University. We're not sure about the rest of the faculty. But the students want to go with their professors, but they're not necessarily sure if they want to be forced to go to this school. And it has serious implications, because they need to transfer their credits. If they go somewhere else, they might have to retake classes. And I spoke to one student, Tanika Garner, who's an Army veteran and a first-year doctoral student, about some of the struggles she's been going through with this process. And here's what she said.
"We never know anything. We find everything out reactively. We never are ahead of the game in any situation. We're never giving any choices. It almost feels like you're a hostage. So it's like a hostage situation or psychological warfare. You don't know what's going on. They're dangling this in front of you.
And so you can really hear the frustration because, as we heard from the APA, the students are really the ones who are most at risk here, because if they go to a program that's not accredited, their degree is worth a lot less than if they go somewhere that is accredited. And both HPU and Chaminade are pursuing this accreditation, and we have no reason to believe that they wouldn't be able to get it. But as the APA said, it's by no means a guarantee. So these students are feeling really uncertain. Tanika wanted to stress she doesn't blame officials at either university for the confusion. It's just a very difficult situation. So what we know at this point is that both Chaminade and HPU are pursuing temporary certification from the APA. That could come as early as May or June, but there could be delays as well. In the meantime, both schools are planning on beginning doctoral classes for students. They are allowed to do that under the rules and then pursue accreditation at the same time. And that's a good thing for Hawaii in general, because we do have a shortage of mental health providers. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, all islands have a shortage of full-time providers. There are some that don't even have a single provider, like Lanai and Molokai don't have a single full-time psychologist. So hopefully in a few years from now, when they both get full accreditation, we'll have three programs that are now producing clinical psychologists.
Right, so at least we have some options for our students here.
Yeah, and hopefully it's some options for the students that are in this bind as well.
Okay, all right. Thanks so much, Ryan. Really
Thank you,
appreciate
Catherine.
Your research. That was HPR's Ryan Finnerty discussing the effort by Chaminade University and Hawaii Pacific University to take over the doctoral psychology program from the now defunct Argosy University. You can find all our reporting on Argosy's closure at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to St. Andrew's Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
The world gave a nod to Earth's trees, marking International Forest Day yesterday. We spent part of the day with Malama Manalua, a group working on a plan to plant trees to save our seas. For our Hawaii Garden and Forest segment, we focus on a statewide effort to survey the boots on the ground and to connect groups like Malama Manalua with others working to protect and restore the Aina. Now, the state wants to hear from canoe clubs, hula halau, school groups, anyone who is helping in the effort to become better stewards of the land. Alex Awo and Doug Harper of Malama Manalua and Rachel Dax and Heather McMillan from the Department of Land and Natural Resources talk about the effort that's underway. Heather starts off our conversation.
International Forest Day celebrated around the world, and here we are sitting at Paiko Bay looking at a beautiful clear water, and we know that part of that clear water is because our forests are working for us. So I'm super grateful to be here right now in this setting. And the other important thing about International Day of Forests is that forests are doing good work for us up Mauka, and we can see those when we turn around and look up at the Ko'olau Mountains. But we also know, and we can hear right now, the leaves are blowing, that forests are all around us. And our urban and community forests, the nature that we encounter every day and the trees that we interact with every day, are as important as the ones that are up Mauka as well in those forests.
Today we had a group Japanese exchange program from Kansai University in Japan in partnership with Kapi'olani Community College. They came to do some environmental work with us to focus on food sustainability and how they can restore ecosystems here within Hawaii. So they helped us remove invasive species of algae that trap a lot of the sediment and erosion and stormwater runoff that comes off of urban landscapes. And a lot of that urban runoff could actually be prevented through certain green infrastructure such as trees. And so planting trees and having that urban forest there to mitigate the effects of erosion and of sediment entering the bay is a really, really important thing here in Hawaii. We have a new project called Plant a Tree, Save the Sea, and it's a new urban tree planting project in which Malama Mauna Lua is partnering up with a lot of different organizations to plant trees in urban areas across the Mauna Lua watershed area. That will help to, like I said, mitigate the effects of stormwater runoff, prevent erosion, and prevent a lot of the harmful chemicals and nutrients from entering our freshwater resources and entering our oceans.
We submitted for a grant maybe 8 months ago. We're awarded it, and so now we're going out and reaching out to, as Alex mentioned, landowners and people who might have places where we can plant the trees. We initially did an assessment looking at where the areas that are the highest potential impact for minimizing stormwater runoff. And so we've targeted a little bit of our work in those areas, but really it's inviting the community that lives in the Mauna Lua Bay region to reach out to us and say that they'd be interested in planting. And then hopefully around May, we will identify what the trees are, reach out to the nurseries, and begin planting.
So the areas that we have identified within the Mauna Lua region, we've used different sets of maps generated by organizations such as Smart Trees Pacific and the UH Manoa Natural Resources Department. So they've kind of done a lot of research to kind of map out areas where there aren't as many trees. So they've looked at things such as canopy cover, they've looked at things such as high potential for stormwater runoff and erosion. And using those maps, we were able to identify very large land areas that would benefit greatly from tree plantings. So we do have a few species of trees that we are advertising to the public for them to plant in their yards. Some of the trees aren't native, so we have a few Mayer lemons and Tahitian limes that are trees and they're good for our environment, but they also have a social and economic benefit for the residents who want to adopt those. A lot of the other trees that have more of an environmental impact are our natives, such as ohia, koa, a'ali'i, wili'wili, and na'u.
So I'm looking up Mauka and up here in Kuli'o Valley. Yeah, you've got a wide variety of things that are growing up there. Explain all the pluses that are associated with planting all these trees.
Right, so the stormwater runoff and erosion prevention are obviously two big ones for an organization that works on the bay, so those are both hugely important to us, but there's also the carbon sink effect of trees. And so they soak up carbon dioxide, which is one of the primary gases that impacts climate change, that causes climate change. And so you're doing your part to try and combat climate change in that sense, but on a more very local scale is that trees provide shade. And so you reduce the urban heat island effect, so that you reduce the overall temperature of where you live. So places like things like concrete suck up heat and then release it throughout the day. And so it increases the temperature. Obviously places with trees have greater shade and lowers the temperature. It also provides blocks the sun for your house. And so for a homeowner, it's an actual economic benefit because it'll reduce the need for air conditioning in your house. And so there's just a lot of different benefits that trees provide, both on a global scale in terms of carbon dioxide sinks, on a local scale in terms of reducing the heat around your house, but then also on a regional scale in terms of reducing stormwater runoff. There's a great new project that's been launched called the Stew Map. And so an organization such as ourselves that's working in a relatively small area and we're a small staff, it's critical that we know what successes and lessons learned have been attempted in other places around the state. And so the Stew Map provides us that opportunity to be able to see who else is out there doing similar work so we can reach out to them and learn from what they've learned. And if they're doing a similar project, maybe we can partner on different things. And especially in a small defined region like the Mauna Lua Bay, it's good to know who's else is working here, but then maybe someone in Kaneohe has done similar work. And so it's good to be able to reach out to them and kind of create a community of stewards here that are learning from each other and amplifying their effect and increasing efficiency.
Right now our project is in this data collection phase, so our survey is live. Over 50 groups have completed their Stew Map survey so far, and the survey contains questions about location where your environmental stewardship occurs, who do you work with, what types of stewardship, and other activities that your organization is part of. Malama Mauna Loa is just one of the over 50 groups that have participated, and we look forward to other groups taking the survey as well. If you've got your survey already, we encourage you to complete it soon. And if you'd like to request a survey, you can visit stewmaphawaii.net, and you'll find a link there to request one.
We know that the community of folks that takes care of our island is really broad. So it's about shining a light on all the good work that is already happening and helping to strengthen those connections where they exist. And the objective of the project is to create visualization, so an online map where you'll be able to see where stewardship is happening across the landscape, and a social map to understand who's collaborating with whom, so that we can understand where the strengths are, but then also see where there are opportunities to strengthen connections and to strengthen those ties.
We were talking with Heather McMillan and Rachel Dax with the State Forestry and Wildlife Division, as well as Alex Awo and Doug Harper of Malama Mauna Loa. You can find links to the program on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travis Motosue and Financial Benefits Insurance, an independent broker specializing in insurance products for seniors. More information at fbihi.com.
That's it for today. Coming up next week, we talk about land, using prime agricultural land for solar, and what happens after the Kuleana land auction on Kauai wraps up today. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Call 941 or 972-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR, and we're on iTunes too. And if you've ever wondered about the music you've heard on the show, find our playlist at hawaiipublicradio.org. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn-Grusby. The backyard theme written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up The Conversation.